This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. You know, a few months ago, we acknowledged the centennial of the end of World War I in 1918. Today, we're going to take a different tack, talk about the war and the music that preceded and occurred during the war. You know, sort of opposition to the war and some music and full support for it in others. And we're going to talk about that with a professor of history at Bismarck State College. Perry Hornbacher joins us from our microphone in Bismarck. Thanks, Perry, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
What will people learn at your presentation? And it's Sunday at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum, and it's titled Experiencing World War I Through Its Music.
Well, that's mainly the title is self-explanatory there. World War I was a war in which it was really the first modern war we ever had. We had modern machines to fight the war. We had modern technology. And we also used the media a great deal. And so music was a form of not only propaganda, but also showing people's attitudes about the war. So when you view the music of World War I, you're actually experiencing it as if you were alive during the time. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts that a historian can do for a presentation is to try to get the people to actually feel like they're during that time, how they would have responded.
Well, that technology that was new and available at that time was the phonograph, which helped distribute music. And we had these movie newsreels that were showing up as well. But we didn't get into the war till rather late in the conflict. It started in Flanders Fields several years before we got into it. So let's start with one of these examples. Tell us about I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier.
Well, right. The war, of course, did start in 1914 over in Europe, and we won't be involved until 1917. So as the media could observe this war, we were watching it in newsreels. We were watching it in different formats. We were experiencing it from the outside. And most Americans did not want to be involved in the war. And the attitude was to stay out of it. We had a large German immigration population in the United States, especially in North Dakota, for example. And many of them did not look forward to potentially fighting their previous homeland. And so the attitude was to stay out of the war as much as possible. So you experience this in a variety of ways. The first song was I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier, which was pretty self-explanatory. It's a song in which the songwriters are saying, we don't want to send our boys off to die in a war, because they're watching this and they're seeing millions by now being killed.
Well, we have an example of this. So our listeners might recognize the melody. So let's hear I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier. Well, that says it all, Perry.
It's very, very basic right up front. And what's amazing about this type of music was this was the age of sheet music. sheet music was everywhere. And you could buy sheet music very inexpensively. So if you get a chance to look a song up, the cover is just quite dramatic, where you have this mother holding her son, basically cradling him and saying, "I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier." So it's quite visually dramatic, too, on the sheet music.
And I think you could probably get it for the pianola, too. So if you didn't want to play the piano, you could actually have the piano play it automatically.
Mm-hmm.
That attitude did not prevail.
No, that was 1915. And although we tried to stay out of the war for quite a while, and Woodrow Wilson actually campaigned in part as the president who kept us out of war in 1916 and won, the momentum was clearly moving towards entry.
Well, let's move to getting there, as a matter of fact, and that's probably best expressed by a very popular song then. People still remember it now. It's by George M. Cohan. It's "Over There."
Get your gun. Take it on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, go today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud her boy's in line. Over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere, so prepare, say a prayer.
All right, the Yanks are coming, and of course this is 1917, later in the year we were actually heading over to the conflict in Europe, and this obviously was to boost support, I take it.
It was. It's considered to be probably the most famous song from World War I. It's actually George M. Cohan's probably most famous song.
Yeah.
He wrote numerous songs. And it's remarkable in that it's sold over 2 million copies of sheet music. And it was like the 11 months at the top 20 list of all sales of sheet music. There's no radio, so there's no top playing list. But sheet music was the way, the barometer of how you were doing in the music industry.
Well, George M. Cohan was a very well-known showman by that time, and of course his life has been portrayed in the movies and in a musical on stage. And if you go to Times Square in New York, you will see a statue of George M. Cohan.
He's
well-known.
And what's interesting, of course, is that he was portrayed in with James Cagney in the movie Yankee Doodle Dandy, and it's quite famous. And if you go online, you can actually hear Enrico Caruso singing it, not only in English but also in French.
So George M. Cohan is helping the war effort, if you will, but it doesn't take too long for those letters to start coming home from the front lines, and the reality of life in the army and fighting a war is quite different from the promotion of it thousands of miles away. So let's listen to another song. This is by another very famous composer, Irving Berlin. "Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning."
The other day I chanced to meet a soldier friend of mine. He'd been in camp for several weeks and he was looking fine. His muscles had developed and his cheeks were rosy red. I asked him how he liked the life and this is what he said. "Oh, how I hate to get up in the morning. Oh, how I'd love to remain in bed. For the hardest blow of all is to hear the bugler call. You've got to get up, you've got to get up, you've got to get up this morning. Someday I'm going to murder the bugler. Someday they're going to find him dead. I'll amputate his reveille and step upon it heavily and spend the rest of my life in bed."
Well, that's kind of a lighthearted approach to what was happening over there. Of course, it was a terrible conflict, devastating losses on all sides. Millions of people were killed in World War I, and then, of course, we had the Spanish flu as well at the same time. So what is this telling us that I haven't already said?
Right. Irving Berlin was actually in the military at that time. He'd been so-called drafted, basically. He's recruited to the U.S. Army. He never saw action himself, but he was posted at Camp Upton in New York, where he did fundraising benefits and put on shows for people. So, and this became part of the Ziegfeld Follies of 1918,
wow.
The song.
Well, Irving Berlin lived a long life. He was 101 when he died in 1989.
Right.
So
he was still around, yes.
Yeah. And famously couldn't play the piano very well, I think. So do you use historical elements like music to teach history at Bismarck State?
Yes, it's one of the – I got partially involved with this project for World War I music because in the context of a classroom, it's really exciting to get a student to actually hear something from the time frame. You can read a document, but it's kind of boring. But if you hear the song and you can play the original song from that time period, it gives them a sense of what they were listening to at that time, what they were talking about, how they expressed their patriotism. And you can find music everywhere. Vietnam War, as I'm sure you're well aware, music, World War I music. And of course, you can go back to even Yankee Doodle Dandy from the Revolutionary War. All these are songs that basically are useful in history to personify the war to an individual, make him have a connection to it.
There's another element here that I think we've talked about, but it seems cyclical. We have this period before we get into the conflict where people are saying, no, let's not do that. Then we get into it, and it's all hands on deck. And then there's the, oh, my goodness, what have we gotten ourselves into? It seems to me we go through these cycles of isolationism and let's go to battle and let's come home from battle over and over and over again, history repeating itself.
Well, in our regards, we have, of course, two huge oceans that protect us. So we can often have a time period where if there's a war somewhere, we don't get hit by it right away. And so sometimes it almost feels like we get dragged into it, which was a feeling that many felt years later after World War I that we got dragged into it. And so that kind of gives that feeling a little bit, and it gives us a little luxury at the beginning. Then we get involved in the war. Of course, we become very patriotic and supportive of the war. World War I, actually, most of the music was – there's no really any anti-war music until – I mean, except before it. Most of the people were very patriotic. It wasn't until years later after World War I that we kind of wondered about it.
Yeah. Well, we're wondering again. I mean, mm-hmm. We're talking now about withdrawing from our normal spheres of influence.
Right. It's an ebbing and flowing of policy. And America, even going back to George Washington's farewell address, warned against entangling alliances. And so it's been a constant theme in American history. How much do you get involved? How much do you separate yourself? And how do you balance that?
You know, sometimes people look at what is taught in higher education with a sort of a flinty eye about what's the real value of this? Well, make the argument for history.
Well, in many ways, as you've already said, history can itself, of course, repeat itself. If you don't understand the elements of what causes the circumstances or actions or then reactions from a policy, how do you then truly prevent it from either happening again or try to do it better in the future? I think, unfortunately, Vietnam probably has the best example of that. You have tremendous studies on what was going on, who was being this way, was the government truthful or not, and then these lessons have to be learned. But sometimes, unfortunately, they seem like they should be relearned every time we have the experience.
What can you tell us about interest in history at Bismarck State College among your students?
Well, it's very good. I think we have a very wide variety of classes. Right now I'm teaching a class called the 60s class, which is fun.
That's my life.
Yeah, and so it is a fun experience, and it's surprising how many students are interested in what was going on with the Kennedy administration or the Vietnam War. And the students, I think, do get a feel for this. And so one of the reasons I use music was to introduce it. So in my history classes, I try to play songs occasionally that give a feeling for the time period for the students so they can make a connection to it. And I think they enjoy the music angle of it because, of course, their life is largely music as well.
I'm struck by how often we use art or artifacts from the time, you know, movies and music and periodicals and scripts and books that are written in a sort of a to entertain or to inform in the context of that time. We use those as tools to explain what happened, history.
Right. Media is a great influence on history. World War I, for example, and we did a presentation last year at the Heritage Center. I did one on the posters of World War I. And that was an example that you're just talking about. Posters were a great, vivid way of getting people to either support the war with Liberty Bonds, recruiting. And so the form of media you use often changes through history, but we still use it.
So have you considered, writing about this?
Well, I did actually write a little bit. The North Dakota Blue Book, I wrote the World War I outline in that one. And I don't really see as any book or anything like that, because there's actually a lot of good material out in World War I already, and I wouldn't presume to try to do that. What I do like doing is presenting sort of not alternative history, but sort of sideline history, like music, posters, cartoons. I've done presentations like Dr. Seuss Goes to War, which is a really fun one because that's when World War II. And so it's really interesting to see how the media has influenced history. We just don't think of it, though, as that way, influencing it. But it does.
And it reminds us of the importance of a heritage center and a state museum as places where we can go and walk amidst this memorabilia and be reminded of the history that got us to where we are today.
Yes, I would love to put a great plug in for the Heritage Center. They had a World War I exhibit that ran several years. They had a lot of these posters that were there. They have a tremendous example of uniforms, and it is free to the public, and it's a great visit.
All right. Well, Perry Hornbacher, professor of history at Bismarck State College, you will be presenting Experiencing World War I Through Its Music at the Heritage Center and State Museum in Bismarck Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. Thank you for spending some time with our listeners.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll have another excerpt from the StoryCorps visit to Bismarck last summer.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring the Cityscape Ballroom. For weddings with a view overlooking downtown, and spaces for bridal showers, rehearsal dinners, and gift openings. More information is available by calling the Radisson at 701-232-7363.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we answer listener questions.
We've got a large stack of it. We get to as much of it as we can, but predominantly it's about Robert Kagan's new important book, The Jungle Grows Back. Kagan is interested in the geopolitical situation of the world, and he believes that as America withdraws from its primacy in Europe, we may be inviting a costly set of wars and conflagrations.
We also clear up a mystery about a melon seed that Pat Brodowski recommended and a couple other book suggestions, including one on beavers and one on George Washington.
And people asked, what is our favorite set of biographies of Thomas Jefferson? And we answer that question.
Ooh, but that's a tough one. There's so many good ones.
If you only can choose one, it's Merrill Peterson's Thomas Jefferson and the New Nation.
So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And today we have another StoryCorps North Dakota excerpt. We'll hear from Patrick Conte, who visited the mobile recording studio with his significant other, Tina Dietz. Conte tells her about his childhood.
Most of the early years, my dad wasn't around. He was over here teaching, moving from school to school, trying to get a full-time professor job.
Okay.
We never really had that teaching me to ride bike or any of that stuff. One day it was like, we're moving, big giant plane, and I remember the smell just, it always would make me kind of nauseous. I didn't like flying. And I think we landed probably in sometime in the winter, because I just remember how cold it was. We're in Moorhead, Minnesota. It was just so different. London's pretty diverse. School was always, there's black kids, there's Indian kids, there's Pakistani kids, there's white kids. But then in Moorhead, it was 99% white. Kind of famous story in my family is when my mom signed my brother up for football, thinking it's football, but it was American football. So my brother shows up to practice in cleats, shin pads, stuff for soccer, and it's American football. So all these kids are in pads and helmets, and he was so bummed out. Just things like that, you know, the different culture, and then just nobody looked like us. My mom's sister had to drive to the Twin Cities to get their hair done because there was nobody in our area that cut black hair. When I was in high school, I went to some salon. They're like, oh, can I get a haircut? And then, so I ended up having to shave my head. I vividly remember there's a small town outside of Moorhead called Barnesville, and they have like a little pond lake in the middle of town. I remember getting out of the car. Everything stopped and everybody turned and just stared. It felt like the record scratching. And then I remember when I started driving, and the same cop one week pulled me over three different times. I got used to it. I remember once I got pulled over and they were convinced that I had something in my car, and they're like, well, we're going to bring a canine and we're going to do all this. And I was like, fine. And it ended up there was four cops there. I hung out with, like, the nerdy kids. We played role-playing games. We didn't drink. We didn't smoke. We would hang out. That's part of the reason, like, I left, you know, at 17, and I was gone for 12 years. I moved down to the Twin Cities. There was an arts high school down there. They accepted juniors and seniors. And then from there, I moved to Chicago, and I stayed there for 9 years and eventually moved back to Moorhead when my dad got sick. So
when you moved to the cities and there were more minorities, how did that make you feel?
It was a bit hard because I had been living in Minnesota my whole life. So, you know, they would be like, man, you talk funny. Like, they were looking at me like I was an alien almost.
What was the best thing about moving to Chicago?
Being in the city again. You don't just see one type of person, you see everybody. Yeah, I didn't stick out. I could just be me, you know?
What was it like coming from Chicago back to Moorhead, Minnesota?
It was hard to sleep because it was so quiet. And then I had to not be so defensive because it was like people here say, oh, hi, hello. But when someone says hi, hello in Chicago, they're probably going to ask you something or it's going to lead to trouble. I appreciate it, you know, and I appreciate that it's more diverse now, and it's, you know, you just don't see one type of person, and, mm-hmm. you know, you see all types of people. I feel like this area is slowly starting
slowly.
To catch up. Yeah, slowly, you know, slowly
very,
still.
Very slowly.
Yeah, it's slow, but it's gotten so much better.
It's progress.
Know? It's progress.
Even I, you know, when we go out places, I feel the stares because we don't match.
We don't match, yeah. It's still in North Dakota in 2018. It's an interracial couple is... Most of the time, I don't even notice the stares, you know. It's like, we're happy.
Right.
You should try it. You know?
Yeah. I love you.
I love you.
Thank you for doing this with
me. No, thank you. This has been amazing.
Dietz and Conte visited the StoryCorps mobile recording booth during its month-long stop in Bismarck this past summer. This excerpt was edited by Prairie Public, and we thank Basin Electric for sponsoring the StoryCorps visit to North Dakota. Coming up on Main Street, our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson, and Matt O'Lean reviews Roma, which has garnered Oscar nominations in several categories. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Tucked away in the plan to fund the federal government is a request for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to delay plans to move some research offices. But Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports the agency is planning to go ahead with it anyway.
The plan is to relocate two departments at USDA, the Economic Research Service and the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. It isn't clear where they'll go, but in a document explaining the spending bill, the conference committee says it's concerned about the cost. It also says they support an indefinite delay of the plan. But Deputy Ag Secretary Steve Sensky says the actual legislation does not stop the relocation. He says the agency will continue evaluating potential sites.
The report language suggests that they just want more information and expect us to provide more information about that, and which we're happy to do.
Some researchers say the move will hurt collaboration and recruitment, but there's no lack of interest. More than 100 groups in 35 states have applied to host the research departments. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
After more than 20 years, an early tool of genetic engineering in crops is showing benefits beyond its original intent. Here's more from Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer.
So-called VT seeds are engineered with genetics from soil bacteria that kill specific insects. For example, a corn seed that won't get devastated by the European corn borer. In reviewing hundreds of studies, researchers now say in addition to protecting crops from specific pests, BT seeds provide additional environmental benefits. Steve Naranjo with the Federal Agricultural Research Service is one of the paper's authors.
Because we can now control certain major pest insects in the crop through this gene being expressed in the plant, that eliminates largely the need to spray insecticides to do the same job.
But Naranjo and other entomologists caution that insects are adaptable and can develop resistance to even the best tools, so they suggest farmers use technology alongside crop rotation and other strategies. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And 2 years ago, the budget for higher education was slashed. The universities lost $123 million. The campuses laid off more than 700 employees, and this happened because of a more than $1 billion state revenue shortfall. This time, the House has approved the higher ed budget bill with a $34.8 million increase. Grand Forks Republican Representative Mark Sanford carried the bill on the House floor.
Higher ed had a significant reduction 2 years ago, as did all of state government. And I just would commend all of the agencies, and in particular higher ed, on the way they dealt with a really challenging revenue stream. They've done a nice job of it. They've made some significant modifications in programs and in delivery models. And so to their credit, they've done pretty well with the reduced revenue load.
The House passed the budget bill 76-13. It will now be considered by the Senate. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
There's the sound of that old wire machine in the background. It's time to talk with the news of the week with our news director, Dave Thompson, who's been around since wire machines.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about this bonding bill that the legislature's been considering.
Yeah, that's really interesting. For a long time, especially since the oil boom, the state has paid cash for new buildings, but there are some new buildings they need to do. They want to do this thing at NDSU, and especially at NDSU at Valley City State. So there is a plan now to actually go out and sell bonds. They said the market is good right now for bonding, and it wouldn't hurt the state to have a little bit of a bond and indebtedness at this time. So
take advantage of the market to get some important work done, and
right.
Won't cost an arm and a leg.
You're talking about Dunbar Hall and then that building at Valley City State, which is on the wrong side of the dike.
Foss Hall, yeah.
Foss Hall, yes.
Let's talk about the income tax issue here. They're talking about using some legacy fund money to basically get rid of a lot of the income
right.
tax.
Right, and this is from the chairman of the House Finance and Tax Committee, Representative Craig Hedlund, who has suggested that they use a portion of the fund, the legacy fund proceeds, to basically reduce our income taxes. I know it got passed in the House. The governor does not like it, and the senators I've talked to are not that keen on the idea. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens when it gets over to the other chamber.
I'm intrigued by this. You know, when I look at my tax bills, my property tax is literally 12 times my income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So it any kind of tax relief, as I'm sure, is appealing to residents of the state.
Absolutely right. And you see there have been several proposals to try to come out different ways to reduce your property taxes, but they're not faring very well.
All right. Well, let's talk about a House resolution that's been defeated that would prohibit the unconstitutional use of property taxes.
Right. Now, the claim is that because the state is so responsible for local education and has really taken over the lion's share of funding, that you should not, as a local school district, be levying any property taxes four schools. That should come 100% from the state of North Dakota. That was the genius of that. And then the, you know, the little property taxes that the state does raise for the University of North Dakota Med School and a few other things, those would all be off the table too. But there is an argument to be made on the other side, and they were making the argument that property tax at the local level gives a sense of local control because then that's something that you can manage.
Okay. Well, here's that issue that keeps coming back. A bill to prohibit sexual orientation discrimination has been heard in a House committee. You had this story.
Right. Had that story, and I do know that the committee has come out with a do not pass on it, and I think it's going to be voted on very soon.
Well, it'll keep coming back.
Yes, it will.
From three boards to two boards to an expanded single board. Dave, we've been talking about this higher ed board for a long time.
It sure has. And when the House defeated the amended bill to make it two boards, one for UND and NDSU, one for the other campuses, when they defeated that, the Senate saw the writing on the wall and they came up with the idea, okay, what we're going to do is do an expanded board, go from 8 members to 11 members. That includes the student who is a voting member. And then there's a plan that the chancellor has to have subcommittees that would be in charge of what the three-board bill was going to do, one for UND, one for NDSU, and one for the other campuses. So that there's some thoughts about that, and that's still kind of being thought about. But it seems to be there is some support growing for making it an 11-member board.
Okay, but this is not what Governor Doug Burgum wanted.
It's not what he wanted, and he's still kind of pushing for that two-board solution because he said he thought that could get through. But it still would be a tough slog to try to get that through the Senate.
Meanwhile, we talked about this last week. The Senate has approved research dollars for NDSU and UND.
Right. It's capped at $45 million. The UND and NDSU presidents actually wanted $100 million to begin with over the next 2 years. They got it to $45 million, and it's capped at a percentage of the legacy fund proceeds as well. Now, the reason they're doing this is because this is new research. They're talking about stuff that, you know, is really cutting-edge research, and the UND and NDSU will have to apply for it. There's a board that's being set up to hand out money for the research. And the pitch is, to do this, you're helping to expand the economy that's beyond commodities, beyond oil, beyond agriculture, with the thought that oil and agriculture are still the big kahunas in the market, and then you're going to have more of a diverse economy coming up if you get some of these research projects out to commercialization eventually.
Well, this bill passed the Senate very easily. It'll be considered by the House, and next week is crossover week. So
that's right.
That's a big time in the legislature. Halfway point?
That's about the halfway point. And actually, the second part of the session is going to be more interesting because some of the bills have fallen by the wayside. Other bills will get a lot more scrutiny and hearings, and it's all going to come down to money. As the March forecast, which has been scheduled right around the 10th of March, they're going to be making decisions after that. And you'll see things get a little bit dicey at points.
Well, we were talking about some research money for the state's two public research universities. UMary knows how to find some money.
It did. How about almost $101 million for the first phase of its three-phase Vision 2030 project? I mean, they had set a goal for the first phase of $96 million. They blew past that and went to $101 million. Now there's going to be a bit of a pause, and then they're going to announce the next goal for phase two. And they're talking about three phases for this.
Well, bully for them. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the legislature. The Senate has okayed the Secretary of State's budget with new voting machines.
Right. And that has been proposed a couple of times. The voting machines that are in place right now are technology that goes back to 2003. And we all know how fast technology moves. And these computers are using software that is no longer supported. So the Secretary of State has wanted to upgrade them, but you need money to do that. 2 years ago, the money was not there. And now they're thinking that they got some money from some sources. They can do this because the real concern, and you heard this from the county officials, that these things are really old technology and they may fail at a very critical time.
Well, the Senate is sending a pretty emphatic message to the House. It was unanimous.
It certainly is.
Let's talk about this House rejecting a bill to change the breastfeeding law in the state.
That was one of the more interesting discussions that they've had because it stems from an incident in Fargo, I think at a local restaurant, where a woman was asked to leave. And she was covered up, but they objected to her breastfeeding. And there's a phrase in the law that they want to take out. Basically, it will allow people then, you know, there'd be less excuse to ask a woman to leave. And in testimony, and I had not heard this, and I was not aware of this, that there's really no law against going topless unless you happen to be breastfeeding a baby. And that, they're talking about that, and that just does not make any sense.
Yeah, you had a statement from Representative Shannon Roris-Jones of Fargo. She's a
right.
Republican, and she said, quote, in your story, it is not indecent exposure for a male or a woman expose their breasts.
Right. But it is if you have a baby attached.
Well, this is an interesting world.
It is.
The dental hygienist bill failed in the House, and that's happened before.
That has happened at least three times that I know of, and this is the idea. The idea of supporters is to bring dental services to underserved areas, especially rural areas and the reservations. The opponents say the problem is there are dentists there, but they leave because they're not getting businesses. People are not really familiar with dental health, and they're not making appointments, or they're not showing up for appointments. And as we all know, to get involved in dentistry is a pretty expensive proposition up front. You've got student loans and you've got all the equipment that you have to buy.
Yeah. And, of course, dental health is actually important for medical health.
It is. Absolutely. So there's the dichotomy there. You've got dentists who are saying, yeah, we're set up, but nobody comes. And the dental hygienist is saying, well, if you brought the hygienist in, maybe we could get some, you know, maybe cleanings or simple extractions or maybe fillings.
Sounds like we need a public education program on this.
I think that's probably right.
Danielle Webster had a story earlier this week about the House passing a bill outlawing the sale of flavored e-liquids to minors.
That's the situation about e-liquids. You know, some of them are marketed like jelly beans, scents and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling is that it does have some nicotine in it, and we're seeing an uptick in use of these e-cigarettes. Especially there are some that if you put them in your pocket, it kind of looks like a flash drive for a computer. So, you know, unless you really look at it, you can't tell the difference. So there's a lot of things at play here.
I know in Minnesota they've had a bill through the legislature that would raise the age of buying tobacco to 21.
Right, and that's being considered too. I haven't checked lately on the status of that.
You had a story this week that there's a bill that would prohibit any weapons on drones. I didn't
right.
know this was being considered.
Well, I remember when this is Representative Rick Becker of Bismarck, when he first introduced this bill was a few sessions ago. And what they did was they decided to make the law narrow so they prohibited any kind of lethal weapons on drones. And then, of course, the Dakota Access Pipeline protest happened and drones were being used. And the legislature turned down any plan to, you know, basically make all weapons illegal because they thought maybe that was an option for law enforcement. Law enforcement doesn't like to put weapons on drones.
Well, that would be giving law enforcement an air force. That would be
That's
something
correct,
new,
yes.
wouldn't it?
It would be.
Well, let's finish with this kind of interesting bill that strikes me that the legislature deals with lots and hundreds of bills.
Hundreds of bills, yes.
And this one is called the ampersand bill, and it's
right.
going through the legislature. Explain this to our listeners.
What it is that if you have a vanity plate, you can have an ampersand. That's the only symbol North Dakota will allow. The trouble is if you're the FBI or some other state, you can't detect the ampersand. The ampersand does not come up as a valid license plate. So they decided, okay, because of these new detection machines, they're basically going to take the ampersand off because – you know, rather than trying to correct all 50 states that they could see an ampersand, they said, well, we're not just going to allow that.
Okay. Well, for those out there who aren't acquainted with it, the ampersand is a symbol on keyboards that means and.
And, exactly.
So no ampersand on our license plates, no
that
exclamation points, no whatever.
No whatever, exactly.
Okay. We check in with our news director every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
So
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota Pool Trust, offering investment options for people with disabilities that protect eligibility for public benefits. Services available in Minnesota and North Dakota. Learn more at lssmn.org/trusts.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We're celebrating our 10th year of radio on Prairie Public with a live taping, music, refreshments, and an exploration of the logic of jazz. Join me and my guest, jazz musician and philosopher, Mark Weinstein, for this free event on Tuesday, February 26th at 7 p.m. at the Empire Arts Center in Grand Forks.
Well, that's the fanfare that tells us it's time for our regular Friday movie review with our resident critic, Matt O'Lean. And Matt, you went to one that's been getting a lot of talk and a lot of nominations, Roma.
Yeah, I didn't see this in a theater, saw it in my living room because it is Netflix only. It got a very brief release in major city theaters in late December. But basically, this was a master stroke by Alfonso Cuarón, the director, and the distribution company, to only put it on Netflix, because I don't know that as many people would have saw this movie had it been a foreign language, you know, film shot in Mexico, foreign language subtitles in a theater. So I think what they've done here is masterful. By marketing this film on Netflix, it has garnered a lot of attention with awards, and I think it's helped get the film out there, and it certainly is probably a slight favorite right now to win Best Picture and Best Director. However, I think it's overrated. You know, last year I really trashed Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. That was just an overwrought film that wasn't that good. This is not a bad film, but I am a little baffled why this is the de facto front runner. It is shot in kind of a chroma TV black and white style, Doug, that I found flat and not terribly exciting. Cuarón shot it himself. His cinematography Oscar nominations, a little baffling to me, except that obviously the Academy likes this film. Most critics have liked this film as well. And I think the problem for me, Doug, is the film has an incredibly slow start. I mean, almost nothing happens for the first 50 minutes. It's based on Cuarón's childhood growing up in Mexico in the 70s, so very personal, done with a lot of loving care, autobiographical. But here's my point. If I was to make a film about myself growing up in Oaks, North Dakota, would that be interesting to me? Or to the viewers, or just me? And I think that's where the problem sets in. It obviously means a lot to him, but I found the long pans, the long tracking shots, to be kind of endless and kind of repetitious. I also felt that Cuarón stands too far back from the action. There's a lack of emotional connectivity to this film. It's all seen through the eyes of the maid, played by Yalitza Aparicio, who plays the maid of this fairly well-to-do Mexican family that Cuarón grows up in. His parents aren't terribly happy. His dad's a doctor. He's away all the time. And the maid takes care of the kids. And Aparicio gives a very fine, kind of subtle, realistic performance. But you never get a sense of how the kids relate to her. So it, because it's seen through her eyes, I never got a sense of the kids being attached to her like it might have been had it been kind of seen through both the kids' eyes and the maid's eyes. So eventually some things start to happen in this film. But again, I just never – it never grabbed me by the throat like I wanted it to. And here's the best thing I can say from a fellow film reviewer, Roger Moore, who reviews films down in Orlando, and I'm going to attribute this to him. He said it's an artistic film, but it's kind of like sitting with Cuarón on a sofa while he pages through family albums, but he's not telling you what the photos mean. I think that is absolutely – accurate. Greg Carlson, our friend Greg Carlson, says Cold War is a much better film, which is also up for foreign language film. Roger also told me he's seen all five of the foreign language nominees. Roma is probably the fourth or fifth best. So I found the film to be long. I found the film's climax to be what everyone's talking about, not emotionally rewarding to me. Look, it's well done. It's nicely shot. It's except for that flat chroma style I'm talking about. But the comparisons to Italian neorealism, which is kind of what reviewers have compared it to, look, Bicycle Thief's a better film. If you're going way back to that, that is a much better picture. I'm just a little baffled why this is suddenly the front runner for Best Picture, because it did not connect to me on the level I thought it was going to connect with me on, and a few other film reviewers are saying the same thing.
Now, is this autobiographical,
yes,
or is it just drawn from his past?
That is my understanding. It is the right age. He's like 11 years old when the film takes place in 1971, 72. So clearly it means a lot to him. But what does it mean? What do some of the images mean to us? And I don't know that he conveyed that effectively enough to me.
Is this something that might be culturally more targeted? For example, would this play well in Mexico or Spain or in a Spanish-speaking country?
Yes. But as you know, Doug, I like foreign language films when they're done well. I don't have to be living in that country to connect. I think if a film is great, it will connect with all audiences. And, you know, I don't know quite what the reaction to audiences are. I know they've liked it less well than critics have liked it. And that's very common on Rotten Tomatoes with a film like this, a very kind of arty film. But just because a film's shot in black and white doesn't necessarily mean it's great. And I look at some of the great black and white films of all time. The cinematography in something like Citizen Kane or Best Years of Our Lives is way better than this. And there's just no... He doesn't go in for a lot of close-ups either. So I'm kind of waiting for that emotional pull of what happens to the maid, her relationship to the family, the big climax, the problem that Aparicio has in her life. Marina de Tavera is quite good as the mother in the film. She got a supporting actress nomination, but I don't see either one of those actresses winning for this film. But clearly the Academy loves this film, and it's probably the de facto favorite right now, which means I'm looking at a second straight year where I'm not – as with it on the Best Picture winner.
Now, it's been nominated for like 4 Academy Awards.
10.
That many?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah.
So cinematography and what else? Everything?
Oh, screenplay and 2 of the actresses, director, picture, a few others in there. I'm not quite sure all the 10, but clearly the Academy loves this film. And I just wonder if it wins, I think you can really give 1/3 of that hardware to Netflix, because wow. I really think that got the film out there the way it would not have gotten out there. Even though Cuarón is a name director, he's Oscar'd for Gravity. He did Children of Men, a lot of interesting films. Little Princess is one of my favorite films that he's done. This one just doesn't have the emotional pull that I was looking for. And people are going to have to see it, check it out on your own. Maybe I'm way off on this. It's not a bad film. I'm not going to sit here and complain like I did about 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which mercifully did not win Best Picture last year. I just think this is a fairly average foreign language film.
Well, for those of us who have Netflix, it's there to view.
Mm-hmm. It sure is.
Well, let's talk about the passing of a really well-known actor, Albert Finney.
Yeah, this happened last Friday, a little too late for us to mention him in the film review. Obviously a towering British actor of the 60s, 70s, even through modern, more recent films like Skyfall, Aaron Brockovich, who most people have seen. He's phenomenal as Julia Roberts' boss in that movie. One of those great actors from that 60s group that came, Doug, as you remember, O'Toole and Kane and Alan Bates and these people. And he was certainly right amongst that. Tom Jones made him a great international star. He's unrecognizable as Hercule Poirot in Murder on the Orient Express. Very chameleon-like actor. We'd heard about some health concerns over the years, but he will be missed, even though he hadn't made a film in a while. I invite people to watch Aaron Brockovich, The Dresser, Tom Jones, 2 for the Road with Audrey Hepburn's another good one, and his big early British premiere or debut, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, where his famous line is, "Don't let the bastards grind you down."
Albert Finney,
yes.
Dead at 82. Well, you mentioned that Alfonso Cuarón has won a couple of Academy Awards, and they were for Gravity, Best mm-hmm. Achievement in Directing, Best Achievement in Film Editing. What was the singular significance of him winning that Best Achievement in Directing Oscar?
He was the first Mexican director to win the Oscar, I believe.
That is correct.
And that's becoming a normal thing in the last few years with Iñárritu and also Guillermo del Toro, dominant Mexican directors.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Who's not a fan of Gilbert and Sullivan operettas? NDSU's Challis School of Music is excited to present Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience, a witty parody of society and one of their most charming love stories. 7:30 Friday, February 15th, and 2 o'clock Sunday, February 17th, at Festival Concert Hall. All the high society ladies in the village are in love with two poets, but the poets are in love with Patience, the simple village milkmaid who has no interest in poetry. Tickets are available at 701-231-7969 or ndsu.edu/music.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 15th. North Dakota is not widely known for harness racing, but on this date in 1913, a North Dakota horse was causing a stir in harness racing circles. It was announced that a great North Dakota star athlete would be leaving the state to compete in the East. Champion harness racing horse Don Densmore and stablemate Don Connemore were relocating to Memphis. Owner Dave Denny of Minot had considered racing the horses himself, but thought the better of it. He explained that the horses would be driven by Pop Gears of the Gears Racing Stable. Gears was one of the most famous harness racing drivers in the country. The horses were scheduled to make their Eastern debut when the season opened in Cleveland on July 12th. Harness racing fans across the country took notice. A Norwich, Connecticut newspaper ran a lengthy article about Don Densmore, saying the horse would be watched with more than ordinary interest. He was a notoriously difficult horse to train and drive, preferring to run in the company of other horses. And although he was fast and had a beautiful stride, it was difficult to get him to outpace his competitors. It was the general opinion that Pop Gears had a knack for handling such a horse, and Don Densmore should run well for him. A Washington newspaper said Pop Gears was going to have a fast stepper, and it was widely expected that the horse would break the world record under Gears' guidance. Chicago sports writer Henry Ten Eek White also thought highly of Don Densmore. He called the horse a sensation and picked him to finish the season as a winner. By August, Don Densmore was labeled a mild contender after finishing second at a race in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The horse finished in the money throughout the season and continued his success the following year. He was also a great sire. In 1915, Sadie Densmore, sired by Don Densmore, established a world record for 4-year-old pacing fillies. While Don Densmore never achieved the fame of the great Dan Patch, he was still considered one of the great harness racing horses of his day. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a consumer-owned power cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with nearly 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
Monday on Main Street, First Fridays at B is a monthly event where people gather to discuss important food topics. This month, it focused on the food worker shortage. And on Monday, we'll look at the problem from the perspectives of three food service professionals. And we'll talk with Nick Archuleta, president of North Dakota United, which represents teachers and public employees in the state, about the bills he's watching at the legislature. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.